This is Nachyomi, Sefer Shmuel Bet, chapter 15. This is the first of five chapters that will detail for us the rebellion of Avshalom, which is one of the centerpieces and a very significant events in Sefer Shmuel and in the life of David. Avshalom is a consummate politician. He patiently and persistently builds a following among the Jewish people over years. He purchases a chariot and horses and hires 50 attendants to serve as his entourage. Then, using considerable political acumen, he brilliantly capitalizes on whatever lingering dissatisfactions there are with David's regime. Avshalom makes sure to get up early in the morning every day, so he's the first person at the front of the palace when people get there. When they come from all over the country with cases to bring before the king, Avshalom greets them and listens to their arguments. Of course, he tells every one of them that the current administration will have no time to deal with their problems, will not be inclined to support them, will not vindicate them. But they would have been vindicated if he were in charge. When citizens would come to bow down before Avshalom, he would grab their hand, lift them up, hug them, kiss them, show that he's a man of the people. And in this way, he establishes a broad base of support across all segments of the population. After several years of doing this kind of political work, Avshalom informs David one day that he plans to travel to Hebron to fulfill an oath that he had made years back. Avshalom recounts that when he was living in Geshur, he said if he ever had the opportunity, if Hashem ever allowed him to come back to Jerusalem, he would offer special sacrifices to God in thanksgiving for that. And so he wants to go to Hebron to fulfill this vow. In the meantime, Avshalom is secretly planning that this is going to be the declaration of his new kingdom. He plants emissaries throughout the cities of Israel and all the tribes who are going to declare that Avshalom is the new king and now rules in Hebron. David hears the news and immediately orders his men to flee Jerusalem because he realizes that they're all in serious danger as a result of this development. He leaves 10 concubines, Pilagshim, to tend to the household and escapes with the rest of his men. All of the servants of David go with him. We then read about a series of people who interact with David and express a desire to join David in exile and how he responds to each of them. Ittai Agiti is a non-Jew who followed David since his time in Gat when he was living under the auspices of Achish, who was one of the Philistine kings. We learned about that in Shmuel Aleph when he was on the run from Shaul. So he had certain people who stuck with him through that time who returned with him, and Ittai Agiti was one of them. He was one of the top generals of David. And he's been one of his top generals for a while now. David urges him. He says, listen, you can stay in the city, serve the new king, go back to your original country. You don't have any obligation to follow me into exile. Listen, you're a stranger to begin with. You came from wherever you came. You came from Gat. You didn't come from here to begin with. And now you're going to follow me into no man's land. Why would you do that? But Ittai, in words that echo, that remind us of the words of Ruth to her mother-in-law Naomi, in a similar situation, declares his absolute allegiance to David and his willingness to follow him wherever he may go, even if it means leading to his own death. Tzadok, the high priest, and all of the Leviim then arrive carrying the Aron, carrying the Ark of the Covenant with them. David tells them to go back to Jerusalem. He tells them that that has been consecrated as the permanent abode of the Ark. If Hashem wills that David be restored to his kingship, then he will once again be able to see the Ark and behold it. But if he doesn't return, the ark should still stay there. He also suggests that Tzadok's that the Kohanim, that the younger Kohanim, can, including Tzadok's son, can be helpful spies who can smuggle information to him from the city if they stay behind. So that's another benefit in having them present in Jerusalem. David and his men ascend the Mount of Olives. They're weeping, they're crying, their heads are covered, they're mourning. At this point, David is informed that Ahitophel, the most brilliant advisor and tactician in the entire realm, has joined forces with Avshalom. Ahitophel's genius in a military strategy is so formidable that David realizes this will make Avshalom almost invincible and unbeatable. This alarms David, and he prays to God to confound the counsel of Ahitophel. Immediately after this prayer, David encounters his closest friend and advisor, Hushai Arki, who has come to accompany him into exile. Hushai was very old, and David tells him straight out that he thinks that it is unwise for him to travel with David. He's going to be a big burden. David instead requests from Hushai that he go back to Yerushalayim and present himself as a supporter of Avshalom. who's loyal not to David in particular, but to whomever of David's descendants occupies the throne. This way he'll get into the situation room, as it were. He'll be able to get it to infiltrate the inner circle, to become an advisor to Avshalom, and hopefully to sabotage whatever advice Achitophel gives to Avshalom. This will also enable Hushai to be a kind of a spy who can find out what the confidential discussions are that are going on in the inner chamber of the king and pass it on through the Kohanim back to David. So he'll serve he'll be the mole. He's going to serve a special clandestine purpose, two clandestine purposes. Now, there are many important ideas to explore in this relatively long chapter. Oh, and incidentally, Hushai, another important point is Hushai gets back to Yerushalayim before Avshalom. So it looks like he never left. And that way, his declaring allegiance to Avshalom is convincing. And it doesn't seem like he's been commiserating with David in the meantime. Now, there's a lot of important ideas to look at this chapter. It's a long chapter, so just to highlight a few of them. So the first thing that stands out, I think, is the political strategy of Avshalom. Now, although his intentions are evil, there's still a lot to learn from his methodical approach to gaining power, because he still demonstrates wisdom and intelligence. His first step is to project an image of power and influence. By acquiring a chariot and a professional entourage, he realized that he had to be respected and seen as someone capable of getting things done. His second move is to be exceptionally proactive in exploiting whatever feelings of resentment and dissatisfaction exist in the people that can bring them over to his side, convince them to support him. Everyone wants to believe and to be told that they're right about everything and that their cause is just. And Avshalom makes sure to tell everyone that he validates their concerns, he validates their claims, their arguments, and that if he were the king, he would decide in their favor. This also explains why Avshalom set up his capital in Hebron. He goes back to the very place that David had abandoned originally when he moved to Yerushalayim. It stands to reason that there were people in Hebron who were unhappy about David's change of capital and felt abandoned by him, that he didn't show favoritism to his own tribe, to the tribe of Yehuda, and instead went for some kind of an intertribal statement of making his capital Yerushalayim. And so Avshalom had a sense that he might be able to build a power base there, which seems like it was correct. The third element of Avshalom's strategy, after capitalizing on resentment and demonstrating his own competence, is portraying himself as a populist, someone reachable, someone accessible. You can't bow down to him. He'll hug and kiss you if you do that. He may be superior to you in certain ways, but he's ultimately one of the people. Ordinary citizens inevitably feel some resentment, distrust of those who wield power because they see them as aloof, distant, indifferent to the concerns of the everyday person. By contradicting this perception with his show of false humility, Avshalom further endears himself to his constituents. Notice that the text specifically tells us that when he would speak to people about their court cases, he would first ask where they were from. That showed an interest in them as people, as individuals. He was inquiring about their background. He was interested in them. He wanted to connect with them. They weren't just subjects. They were human beings. And this feeling of being important, feeling of being significant, is one of the key ways that Avshalom builds their trust and their love for him. Now, more than anything else, you have to be impressed by Avshalom's patience and diligence, his forbearance in plotting this rebellion. Avshalom is calm and collected throughout, and he's very calculated, and that's why he's so dangerous. His ambition and inner discipline are what allow him to succeed in the long term and complex project of overthrowing his father. In other words, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. He needs to stay the course over quite a long time. And we see that this is something Avshalom is always capable of, because when it came to Amnon, who violated his sister, he waited 2 years quietly, didn't say anything, didn't cause any trouble, didn't indicate that he had any plan to harm him. And then suddenly, when the opportunity arose, he took it. So you see that he is a patient person. He is he's not in a rush. And therefore is capable of accomplishing great things in the long term. It's also difficult to overlook the similarities between Avshalom's political strategy and the style of modern election campaigns that you see today. It's a little amusing to see the similarity. The management of the candidate's image, efforts to tarnish the reputation of the opponent, capitalizing on the pre-existent disappointment in the current administration, the emphasis on the humanity and accessibility of the candidate Avshalom, who portrays himself as a man of the people, as contrasted with the out-of-touch political insiders who think of themselves as greater than the average person and are wedded to the establishment. You know, Avshalom is trying to show himself as an outsider. and the penchant for promising everyone everything that they want and telling constituents whatever they want to hear in order to get votes. All of this is just like what we see in politics of today. You see that not much has changed on a fundamental level from what it's always been. This is the way that politicians have gained support for millennia. Now, one question to be asked is, what is the relevance of Avshalom's politicking to the prophetic message of the book of Shmuel? I mean, it's very clever, it's very creative, it's interesting, but why is it important to us to learn from a spiritual perspective, from a religious perspective? I think that the reason why it's so critical, why it occupies so much space, is because we have to understand the danger of it. We have to understand that when great leaders disconnect, they withdraw, they become passive, they fail us, they leave a vacuum that will be filled by ambitious people like Avshalom, who use the superficial tactics of politics to take advantage of people. The success of his tactics show how far removed David is from the scene. He was incapable of keeping the minds and hearts of the Jewish people attuned to him and connected to him. This is why David flees the palace so quickly when he hears Avshalom has started a rebellion, and why he gets such minimal support after being a beloved king for so long and after having done so much for the Jewish people. He has lost interest in them and they in him. He's become absorbed with his own woes. Ever since the sin with Bathsheba, he was never the same. And so Avshalom is easily able to work his way into the hearts of the people. He occupies the void that David created by his absence. Now, had David continued to be the inspiring, confident, fearless leader he had once been, the rebellion of Avshalom would have had no chance. But David's adopting the passive attitude toward governance gave the green light to Avshalom to pursue his agenda by alienating the population and even convincing Achitophel, his longtime advisor, that the future was really with Avshalom and not with David. We will hopefully address David's reaction to the arrival of the Ark in a future summary when we discuss how David understood his whole ordeal from a religious perspective. But for now, one last thing to consider is the prayer of David, which shows us an important lesson about the philosophy of tefillah, of prayer. You see that David recognizes the threat posed by Achitophel's advice and involvement, and he prays to Hashem that Achitophel's influence should be neutralized. Moments later, Hushai appears and becomes David's agent for accomplishing that goal. So David understood that prayer to Hashem is not a substitute for human effort. If anything, it prepares us by clarifying for us what steps we need to take to achieve our desired objectives. We rely on Hashem to handle those aspects of the situation that are beyond the sphere of our control. But in the process of reflecting on where Hashem's involvement is going to begin, where ours ends and Hashem's begins, it opens our eyes to what we need to do, the steps we need to take to contribute to the process. And that's exactly what happened with David. He had it fresh in his mind. It was clear in his mind what he needed to do in terms of his part to undermine Achitophel. And he does that, and he does it very well. And with the help of Hashem, he survives this terrible ordeal.